Hello and welcome to another episode of Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact. My guest today is Isabel Hilton. Isabel is a London-based international journalist and broadcaster. She studied at the Beijing Foreign Language and Culture University and at Fudan University in Shanghai before taking up a career in written and broadcast journalism, working for The Sunday Times, The Independent, The Guardian, and The New Yorker. In 1992, she became a presenter of the BBC's flagship news program, The World Tonight, then BBC Radio 3's cultural program, Night Waves. Isabel is the author of several books and is founder and editor of ChinaDialogue.net, a nonprofit, fully bilingual online publication based in London, Beijing, and Delhi that focuses on the environment and climate change. Isabel holds two honorary doctorates and was awarded the OBE for her work in raising environmental awareness in China. Welcome.
Thank you, Paul. Lovely to be here.
So lovely to have you. So I want to start discussing the kind of preeminent relationship in international affairs between the two world's great superpowers, China and the US. It's fair to say that it hasn't been going well, that there have been in some degree of challenge and confrontation for some time. And efforts has been made to ring fence climate negotiations outside of what is a difficult and contentious relationship. And I'm interested in your take on that, because obviously having these two enormous emitters agree both between themselves and as between the rest of the key countries in our quest to net zero is going to be very important. So how's that going?
I wish I could tell you it was going well, but it's not going particularly well at the moment. And, you know, if you take the long view, you can see that we're really not doing well right now. I don't know if you remember that 2 years before the Paris Agreement, Xi Jinping and Barack Obama shook hands, drank a glass of champagne, and agreed to work together to bring about the Paris Agreement. And that was hugely important because Copenhagen had broken down essentially over the contentious US-China relationship, amongst other things, but that was a big one. So for them to, you know, focus on the same objective was transformative. And along with some rather brilliant French diplomacy, it delivered the Paris Agreement. There was a whole raft of cooperative arrangements. There were Chinese provinces working with American states, you know, working on, you know, this common problem. And that all sort of went okay pretty much until Trump, although the background was an increasing sense of competition geostrategically between the US and China. Trump comes in, pulls out of the Paris Agreement, and also trashes China, you know, in public discourse. That was part of his politics. You know, China's raping the United States. He starts a trade war. So things begin to go downhill. We limp along to COP26. And one of the bright spots in Glasgow in the first week was the announcement that China and the US would set up a limited cooperation, but nevertheless, a cooperation on climate. It was noticeable, however, that they made this announcement separately. There was no kind of shaking hands between John Kerry and Xie Jinhua, who are on a personal level good friends. But the degree of suspicion, you know, between their respective nations was such that I think they just were more comfortable announcing this separately. But nevertheless, it was progress because things had got so bad. So they were going to work together on methane. There were a whole, you know, kind of limited but positive program was going to go ahead. And the sense was that, you know, if these two superpowers and the world's two biggest emitters are fighting each other, it just distracts the whole process. You know, you need positive energy to move this rather complicated process forward. Their quarrel is negative energy. So there we were, December last year. However, roll on to today, and we've had Putin's invasion of Ukraine with China kind of on the wrong side. We have had Nancy Pelosi's visit to Taiwan, which was the immediate trigger for the suspension of that cooperation agreement between the US and China. So now we don't have anything. There is no cooperation between the two of them. They're taking pot shots at each other over climate. You know, Biden, reproached Xi Jinping for not turning up to the UN. It's not great. And there's just a lot of messy rhetoric. The foreign minister, the Chinese foreign minister, Wang Yi, had said, you know, you can talk about ring fencing climate in the middle of, you know, negative bilateral relations, but it's a bit like trying to save an oasis in the middle of a desert. Sooner or later, the desert will take it over. And what were the desert is, you know, advancing on this particular oasis right now.
And the consequence of that, I mean, we're about to go into COP at Sharm el-Sheikh. And is it your view that we're going to have far less progress than we otherwise would have because of this vanishing oasis that is the relationship?
Well, I think undoubtedly. Look, there are a lot of things that are getting in the way of Sharm el-Sheikh. This has not been a great year. But again, if the US and China work together, then, you know, a lot of the noise around this disappears and they can focus on common objectives. They're not working together. And that positive diplomatic dynamic is missing. So we won't get the kind of progress that we need to get. I'm not at all confident about Sharm el-Sheikh as of now, honestly. You know, we limped out of COP26. COP26 was a recovery COP, if you like. We, you know, there was a lot of business to do, the rule book to finish and so on. But actually, in terms of upping the ambition, which was originally what COP26 was meant to do, a bit, but not very much. Now, we've had a really big event since then, which has been the passage, finally, of the IRA, the Inflation Reduction Act, which is actually all about climate. It's a weakened version because of Senator Joe Manchin's holding out for quite so long, but it's still huge. You know, the US is back in the game, and it's going to be very important. So that's the positive side. If we can't get the US and China to cooperate, which looks pretty complicated right now, the next best thing is for them to compete, you know, in virtuous terms, not a race to the bottom, but a race to the top. And the passage of the IRA puts China back on its mettle. You know, as long as we were still in kind of Trump legacy America, there wasn't really very much pressure on China, you know, to raise its ambition. It had already done quite a lot and it was coasting. But now, you know, if the US really gets moving, then China, which measures itself entirely against the United States, has something to prove.
So I want to try and understand that competitive dynamic. Part of it may just be a competitive dynamic driven by a sense of status and prestige. The US is doing better than China. Part of it may be actual competition for the market in sustainability, for the transition to net zero, wind turbines, solar panels, the infrastructure and the IT required to get us there, that may be enabled by the IRA and the Chinese feel as though what was a competitive advantage is being eroded. How much is it about economic competition and how much is it in geopolitical, strategic, and status competition that is in fact driving this this competition? That I agree, if they're not going to cooperate, let them virtuously compete. But what's the actual competitive dynamic there?
The competitive dynamic between the US and China is the rising power challenging the incumbent power. I mean, that's without a doubt. And actually, Xi Jinping is a nationalist. He's highly nationalist. Since he came to power in 2012, he has taken China in a much more assertive direction. So South China Sea, lots of language on Taiwan, Hong Kong, Xinjiang, all of those things, which are challenges to the established order in many ways, you know, to the what we like to call the rules-based order. But they're also about a display of power to his domestic constituency. I'm making China great again is, you know, essentially his message. And who do you measure yourself against? Well, it has to be the United States. The United States, on the other hand, has, you know, come to see China as a threat because partly in response to the nationalist tone, you know, a rising China which was hugely enabled by, you know, China joining the WTO, you know, coming into the global market at a time of enormous globalization, becoming the world's factory. All of that enabled the rise of China, and rather on the assumption that China had a big interest in the global order and that it wouldn't seek to destroy it. It doesn't exactly seek to destroy it, but it does want to rewrite the rules in ways in which a lot of us are quite uncomfortable. In the United States, the UK, Western Europe, increasingly uncomfortable with China's, you know, approach to global rules. Clearly, it's trying to rewrite, for example, human rights rules, you know, but quite a lot of other things. Added to that, there was a sense that China had used its WTO membership to undermine Western industrial capacity. And there's some truth in that also. So, you know, there were a lot of causes building up. On climate, however, you know, China had recognized around 2005, 2006, both that, you know, when it became the world's biggest emitter, it kind of had to do something. There was, you know, there was something to address here, having actually previously been a non-Annex I signatory of the Kyoto Protocol, in which, as a developing country, China didn't really have to do much. However, 2005, 2006, it becomes such a big emitter that clearly action is required. And, you know, there isn't a big denialist problem in China. They get it. They understand basic physics. They know China's vulnerable. But it also coincided with a moment when the catch-up phase of China's industrial economy was pretty much played out. And at that point, like every other Asian tiger, China needed to get smarter, move up the technology value chain, become more efficient, all of those things. And thinking about how to get through the middle-income trap, they identified, they were looking for the technologies of the future that China could dominate. And they identified low-carbon technologies and began to invest very heavily from 2008 onwards in dominating low-carbon technologies. So wind, solar, batteries, electric vehicles, etc. And in dominating the supply chain of the metals required to enable an energy transition. And those are so-called rare earths, which, you know, are pretty much available everywhere, but the processing of them and the mining of them had kind of been abandoned to China, largely for environmental reasons. You can find these things in Colorado, but people in Colorado don't want dirty mining. So, you know, it had pretty much gone to Mongolia and other parts of China. So now we find ourselves in a situation in which the world needs an energy transition. It's embarked on an energy transition, and almost every bit of kit is either made in China or is supplied by China, or indeed could be withheld by China. And China has withheld the supply of rare earths for political reasons in the past, to Japan, for example. So it's a curious situation to be in. And part of the IRA is to restore an industrial policy to the United States so that effective competition, relying on American innovation, technology, and so on. But there is a rare earth problem. And, you know, if things get really difficult with China, China is quite capable of weaponizing supply chains for other objectives. So it's not entirely straightforward. On the upside, China's capacity to manufacture at scale has lowered the price of all of this for everybody. So the solar panels on my roof are cheaper because they're made in China, and China has just developed fantastic supply chains. And it means that in most places, it's cheaper to install renewables than to build new coal or new gas. And in some places, it's cheaper to install renewables than to run new old coal and old gas. And that's a massive contribution.
So you mentioned weaponizing supply chains, and there's probably no greater current embodiment of that than Ukraine and the conflict there. And obviously, you know, that's a proxy war in some respects, the West and China, West and Russia battling it out. And one of the fascinating things about China is that it has managed to avoid being ensnared in the sorts of conflicts and wars in proxy terms that the Russia and the West have, or Russia and the United States have in recent years, which have bled them dry in terms of blood, treasure, prestige, focus. Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, Ukraine, just to name a few. What game is China playing in Ukraine? Because it's obviously expensive, unhelpful, economically destabilizing, and it could certainly weigh in if it chose to end the conflict. But it seems to be, for reasons that may have a little to do with self-harm, interested also in prolonging it. So I'd love to hear your view on that.
There are a number of ways of looking at China's position in Ukraine. You may remember Putin went to Beijing for the Winter Olympics, and while there, Russia and China signed, Xi Jinping and Putin, signed this long document, 5,000 words, of their view of the world, in which they laid out that essentially all the problems in the world were caused by the West, and particularly the United States, that they, Russia and China, were benign powers interested in peaceful development. But they took each other's core interests to heart. So Ukraine was mentioned, Taiwan was mentioned, and that their friendship was limitless. Right. Okay. 2 weeks later, Putin invades Ukraine, and you have to think, well, come on. Either Xi Jinping was a fool or a knave. He was either played by Putin or he was complicit, and this is really not a good look. China, at the same time, and indeed in this document, talks about the absolute fundamental values of territorial integrity and sovereignty and so on, but without apparently thinking that, you know, it might apply to Ukraine. So they didn't take a formal position in Russia's favor. They have not breached sanctions, as far as I'm aware. They've been very careful about that. They have tried to present themselves as a kind of peaceful interlocutor, but have not taken calls from Zelensky, have not intervened in any particularly meaningful way, as far as we can see, and have given diplomatic cover to Putin in several instances since then. And if you look at the domestic propaganda, China is just replaying Moscow's narratives on the war. The only crack that I've seen recently in this was in Kazakhstan the other day, when Putin volunteered that he understood China's concerns. China hadn't voiced those concerns, but clearly had in private, and Putin had felt obliged to say something. One of those concerns might be that among the countries that have guaranteed Ukraine's integrity against nuclear attack, which several did when Ukraine gave up its own nuclear weapons, is China. So that were Russia to use any, you know, nuclear device in Ukraine, China is, by its own treaty with Ukraine, obliged to come to Ukraine's defense. So if I were Xi Jinping, I would be leaning very, very hard on Putin over that. And I would also be leaning quite hard on him to, you know, try and bring this mess to a close. My sense is that Putin told Xi Jinping back in February, and he told him that this was going to be just a very limited operation, that, you know, it wouldn't really disturb anyone very much. And Putin, has messed up, and Xi Jinping is kind of uncomfortable and embarrassed, but stuck. He's not going to abandon Russia.
So you're a very keen observer of China and China's strategic relationships. How much actual power do they have in relation to Russia? So if they were to say stop and were to decide that they wanted to say stop, would that have real consequence for Russia? Or is the relationship one in which they aren't going to say stop for reasons you may have just alluded to, or don't want to say stop because they are concerned about sort of balancing a three-legged stool between Russia, China, and the United States?
I think ideally what China would like would be to appear the peacemaker. Now, they're not going to take that risk until they're sure that Putin is willing to, you know, make concessions or, you know, make a meaningful peace. Until then, I think China will sit on the sidelines and say nothing to do with us, really. they can, in private, put a lot of pressure on Russia because, you know, one of the places that Russian oil and gas have been going, of course, is China. China's benefited quite a lot, more from oil than from gas. It's actually quite difficult to get European gas to China because the infrastructure isn't there. The diplomatic cover has been important. The only, you know, public occasions for Putin in recent months have been essentially facilitated by China, the Kazakhstan summit and so on. And the pretense that Russia still has a kind of normal, if you like, diplomatic position. China is the largest trading partner of most of the UN General Assembly. So when a vote comes up that China doesn't want passed, criticizing China for human rights, for example, you will notice that these votes don't get through anymore in the General Assembly. That has been true of Ukraine. Now, China could stop using its diplomatic weight in Russia's favor. It could stop buying oil. I mean, and Xi Jinping could get on the phone and say, you know, you've got 6 weeks to bring this to an orderly conclusion. What it's costing China is, a stable world order. And China needs a stable world order because it's still essentially, you know, dependent on export markets. It's dependent on, it doesn't want a world in which there is a permanent energy or food crisis. It needs to continue to thrive. The Chinese economy is going to grow at less than 3% this year. Zero COVID has given it a, you know, massive hit. So for Xi Jinping to present himself at home as a big success, he needs better global conditions. And right now, of course, the biggest threat to a stable world remains the Russia-Ukraine crisis. He could. He will choose his timing. He will get the party Congress over, and he will try to ensure that when he makes an offer, it will be taken up.
So let me shift now to some specifics around China's climate policy, because I know you follow that closely. If you were to just step back and scorecard China on a path to achieving net zero emissions by 2050, by that, listeners, it would have to halve its emissions by 2030, halve again by 2040, and then do the remaining 25% from 2040 to 2050. And obviously some sectors are easier to do radical carbon reduction on than others, but not so if you're the world's largest manufacturer and the world's second largest, soon to be largest economy. How is China doing in just absolute terms on the path to net zero?
The promise that Xi Jinping made at the UN General Assembly was actually 2060, not 2050. So that's the first, you know, slipping decade. The second promise in that particular speech was to peak emissions well before 2030. That's a very loose target. It was on the table in Paris. It hasn't tightened up. And even back, you know, in the Paris Agreement, if you talk to Chinese analysts, they would say pretty much we could do it by 2022, 2023. So China likes to set loose targets and fulfill them early rather than miss them. It's just that's also intrinsic to the Chinese system, you know. It's very bad for your career if you miss a target. But if you fulfill it early, you know, hey, you get promotion. So what has China managed to do? Well, the world's biggest installation of renewables, I mean, by a very long way. That also includes nuclear and hydro, which people may feel rather less enthusiastic about. Coal as a proportion of primary energy is down from, gosh, more than 80% to less than 50%. And that's big. You know, China's energy density has improved a great deal. And that's the amount of energy that you use to create, you know, a dollar value of GDP or whatever. That's, you know, a long-term project, which has gone very well. So it's much, much more efficient. And it has sectoral plans for steel, cement, for the, you know, the big hard-to-abate sectors. And it has a number of kind of ongoing experiments in things like carbon capture. and which, you know, everyone has a kind of vague interest in, should the economics ever work out. Internationally, and remember that China is, you know, one of the biggest actors on the world stage now in terms of infrastructure, in terms of development. Since 2013, with the Belt and Road Initiative, China has built a huge amount of fossil capacity almost everywhere, but has now promised no more new coal on the Belt and Road. And secondly, that instead of building new coal, China will help emerging economies to develop renewables systems. And that, if that works, would be, again, hugely important, because you have a lot of countries that need to develop that would traditionally have gone the way we all did, through coal to oil and then, you know, to mitigation. And honestly, there's hardly any carbon budget left for that kind of development. And that kind of development is no longer necessary. But countries need technological supplies, they need technical support, they need investment, they need all of those things in order to bypass the fossil fuel stage of development. If China can really develop a policy, and it's not quite there yet, but the promise is there, if its policy becomes that, then again, that's another big contribution. So on mitigation, on meeting targets, no, not there yet, but, you know, not entirely negative. This last 2 or 3 years has not been great because of energy security concerns, and in China that means coal. And finally, on the negative side, China has never really accepted 1.5 degrees. It didn't like it in Paris, thought it was an American plot, always argued there's no pathway to it, went silent about it. But now we're beginning to hear from the negotiating room that, you know, 1.5, unrealistic, you know, we shouldn't be talking about it from China. That is extraordinarily unhelpful. So it's a mixed picture, but as the world's biggest emitter, you have to welcome all progress, acknowledge, you know, a lot of effort, and wish for Godspeed in doing the rest. Maybe speed up quite a lot, please. Yeah.
I suspect we have touched on it in other conversations that you've been a participant in at the Conduit in relation to two questions. The first is the relationship between democratic and authoritarian rule and climate politics. And the second is the relationship between human rights, modern slavery, and climate supply chains, mainly in Xinjiang. So let me ask the questions in order. China, above all else, needs to grow its economy in order to support its population. But it also needs its population to live in conditions that are healthy and doesn't have choked air and poisoned rivers, etc. And so it's had this view of let's grow, but let's move to net zero because it's necessary for these two opposite imperatives to meet. How much do you think its authoritarian top-down model has been helpful in the transition to net zero, as politically distasteful and as popular as that answer might be, but just an objective factual matter, has it got there quicker and more effectively than a democracy might?
It's a really interesting question, and it does come up a lot in these conversations, and particularly if you're talking about India and the frustrations of trying to get things done in India and so on. When I started China Dialogue in 2006, the absolutely universal official view was develop first, clean up later. The environment is something rich countries can afford, we can't. And it got to the point where you couldn't see across the street in Beijing and people were out demonstrating and dying 6 years earlier in the north than in the south of China. And air quality was actually one of the huge drivers. The party doesn't hold elections, obviously, but it does keep quite close track of public opinion. And when an issue becomes very large, it tends to act. So it responds in some ways to public opinion. What we have now, though, is a far more authoritarian version. You know, we're not in 2006 anymore. We're in a highly ideological, highly authoritarian, highly nationalist China. Now, that's okay, As long as the policies align with climate, and Xi Jinping actually has a track record on environment and climate, which is pretty good. That doesn't mean he can just wave his hands in Beijing and, you know, in distant Sichuan policy falls into place. Because as in any enormous country, you know, everything, power is negotiated in China, as it is everywhere. So there are legacy industries, there are vested interests, there is, you know, a huge fossil-based economy, there are technological problems with China's national grid, for example, which is the world's largest man-made structure, is China's national grid. And it's not really up to the job yet. So a lot needs to happen. A lot needs to happen in terms of, you know, simple trading of power between provinces, which, you know, you have a command economy, to get back to your question. It's still a command economy, which works on five-year plans. Coal-fired power stations have annual contracts. So when you have, you know, build up the renewables quota of your energy mix, you get what's called curtailment. So, you know, the coal-fired power is paid for, so it sits on the grid, and you have a burst of high wind in Inner Mongolia, and they have to detach the sales because, you know, they can't take it on the grid. So it's kind of push me, pull you. And whilst the direction from the top has been pretty steady, and it includes things like, you know, developing models of circular economy, you know, it's quite comprehensive. That's the upside of a planned economy. The downside is that, you know, if something isn't working, it takes a long time to correct. Authoritarian governments don't self-correct, and you can see it in zero COVID now. They're stuck because, you know, the boss has committed himself to zero COVID and there isn't a graceful way out. It was far worse under Mao when, you know, 60 million people starved to death because Mao couldn't reverse the Great Leap Forward. So you have, it's possible that if in an authoritarian system, assuming the policy from the top is good, that it can move through the system and then you get everything aligned, you get industrial policy aligned, you get investment aligned, allowing for the fact that there is always resistance in the system, so it's not instantaneous. Of course, when an authoritarian system is not aligned with climate policy, then you know, nothing to be done.
And on the question of ultra-cheap solar panels being made by Uyghurs in conditions of slave labor, obviously that's a shorthand. Obviously it doesn't happen across the board, but I think there are credible reports of saying that, you know, it is happening in certain instances, and that is net-net driving down the costs of those solar panels, but at very much at the expense of the Uyghurs. How do you think we address this conundrum? Because it just, you know, puts two complicated imperatives at war with each other, you know.
I think this is one of the most difficult things. I mean, obviously, you know, climate change is an existential threat to everyone. But, you know, to ignore the human rights aspects of China's production is morally bankrupt. So we can't. What I suspect will happen is that there will be some triage. I think being aware of where China's manufacture happens, I think we have to be fairly accurate because, for example, on cotton, it's really very difficult because things get mixed up. And there has been some rather loose kind of blanket condemnation. So I think, first of all, be sure that the data is accurate. Be sure that what you're blocking is needs to be blocked. And then block it. Actually, China will probably sell it elsewhere anyway. It's not going to change the system. You need to be quite clear about that. But build up the capacity to manufacture elsewhere. It's one of the things we can see in the IRA is that, you know, the US has an industrial policy again. Making solar panels is not very complicated. You can do it in lots of places. We can do it in different countries that need an industrial base. So that's not hugely complicated. And I think that to abandon all human rights considerations for climate change is wrong. It's also worth noting, actually, that the United Nations General Assembly passed a resolution a couple of years back saying that the right to a healthy environment was a human right, and that encompasses climate change. Now, China abstained on that, but I think, you know, to if we're having a human rights discussion with China, that is one of the conversations to have, and that, you know, that's something I think that China would find difficult to avoid. It doesn't like civil and political rights, as we know. It has always favored economic rights and the predominance of states' rights over individual rights. But the right to a healthy environment is pretty, it's both economic and, you know, covers health, livelihood, all of those things. So that's a kind of starting point, I think, for a conversation with China on human rights.
So a final question, if I may. It seems to me that China's leader and the personality and positioning of that leader matters a great deal. Seems to be subject to fewer constraints in general, but in this particular instance with this particular leader, almost certainly so, than Western counterparts or democratic counterparts. And therefore, if you're interested in China playing a more liberal, a more internationalist, a less belligerent, a less confrontational, a more respectful of a rules-based order role in the world, you have to think of a way of it being post-Xi. What does that look like? How likely is that to happen? And who is the likely successor going to be? And how long are we stuck with the current leadership?
Well, one of the objectives that Xi Jinping has for the upcoming party congress, the imminent party congress, is at least another 5 years as president. He's also general secretary of the party and chair of the military commission, and those posts, which are the ones that matter, don't have any time limit. He has managed to consolidate power pretty effectively through a thing called, he's actually taken power back into the party and particularly into his own hands, away from the state. So he's taken a lot of powers that used to reside in ministries and set up what are called leading small groups, which he tends to chair. And they're really driving policy. So, you know, he has consolidated all power pathways at the moment do lead to Xi Jinping. What's curious, though, is that 10 years in, he is still finding it necessary to conduct purges. And purges, including purges of the security services. And you think a decade in, either people are plotting, which is, I guess, possible, or he's increasingly paranoid, which is also possible, and neither is particularly good. Authoritarian regimes do tend to see threats everywhere. They tend to jump at shadows because they project their own fears and fantasies onto others. It's not particularly healthy. He has a lot of problems. You know, the economy's going down. The property sector, which has been one of the huge drivers of the economy for 20 years, is in bankruptcy, essentially. You have people who've paid for houses that haven't been built who are very angry. You have people who can't get their money out of banks who are very angry. He has an awful lot to deal with. And I think that he has enough enemies that the first signs of weakness, you know, he becomes vulnerable. Now, what will happen then? I don't know. I mean, I'm not predicting a coup against Xi Jinping at all. There was a series of rumors a couple of weeks back, and my view is, look, if we can see the signs, it's not going to happen, because so can he. And the only way we're going to know about it is if it were to happen would be after the event. And there's also a, you know, be careful what you wish for element. I don't think a divided, unhappy, miserable China is particularly to anyone's benefit either. So my ideal scenario would be some kind of peaceful transfer of power. He has not chosen a successor. Being the nominated successor in China, I have to say, is one of the most dangerous jobs in China. Very few of them survive.
And, why is that?
Well, because they obviously become a threat to the incumbent. And, you know, think of Lin Biao, Liu Shaoqi, you know, they didn't survive. What he has done is to change the system that Deng Xiaoping essentially left as his legacy, as his defence against, you know, authoritarianism, which was far more shared power and term limits. He's done away with that. So now he has to make it work for him, and that's not going to be easy.
Isabel Hilton, such an extraordinary conversation, such a keen observer of both geopolitics and China and climate change all in one pithy download. So we'll invite you back if you'll come back. But I think that to crisply articulate all of that in the way you have is a real blessing. So thank you for your time.
Paul, it's been such a pleasure, and I will come back anytime.
Delightful. Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Please do subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. And for more information about The Conduit and our community of changemakers, please visit theconduit.com.